This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This week on Witness History, the Unabomber terrorised Americans in a 17-year bombing campaign, killing three people. I've been speaking to Special Agent Kathleen Puckett, who reveals how the FBI tracked him down. Listen on Witness History, the podcast that takes you to the biggest moments in history, told by the people who were there. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease, where later we'll be hearing about ammonia on the rocks, using a bit of geothermal energy to make vital fertilisers without harming the climate.
We will have sufficient hydrogen ammonia supplying all our energy needs and chemical needs for the next 250,000 years and beyond.
We're also hearing about 2024's record deadly landslides and Whistling in Space, new recordings put old theories to the test.
It's a surprise. It's a big surprise, actually.
The Arctic is waking up in concerning ways because of global warming. We already knew that temperatures there are rising four times faster than the global average. For example, the polar air that's descended to the states around the Gulf of Mexico, bringing unprecedented and attention-grabbing snowstorms, has left behind it, without the same attention, unusual warmth over the Canadian Arctic, a glimpse of the broader changes affecting the far north. But the question has been whether the region's ecosystem would respond by releasing more greenhouse gases, adding to those we put there into the atmosphere, or actually soak up some of our carbon pollution. The evidence this week is it will add to our problems, particularly because of the massive wildfires we've seen in Canada and Siberia in recent years. In the past, says study lead Anna Verkula, these areas have been a sink for carbon.
So the Arctic boreal region has, in the south, it has these boreal forests that are highly productive. And then in the tundra, we have grasslands, shrublands, and also quite sparsely vegetated areas as well. And also in both of the boreal and tundra biomes, we have wetlands. All of these ecosystems, all of these plants, they take up carbon via photosynthesis, and then they store it into the soil as well as organic matter. Peatlands are, and wetlands, they are very, very big carbon stocks, carbon reservoirs. But actually, throughout the whole Arctic boreal region, even in forest, even in drier tundra areas, there is a lot of organic matter in the soil that stores carbon. And then the key player is also permafrosts. So The soils in the Arctic, they have been cold. So this microbial decomposition has been very slow. So that has allowed the carbon to accumulate into the soils. And then when we add permafrost on top of that, that permafrost is the frozen ground that's continuously frozen. So it kind of saves and stores the carbon and organic matter in the soil, and it cannot go back to the atmosphere.
So the two stories which I've heard about what happens as the Arctic warms up. One is that it means that the growing season gets a bit longer, that plants can grow a bit more, but also that at the same time, bacteria can start chomping on the dead stuff
and turning it back into carbon dioxide. I mean, what's the status then, according to your paper, of those changes?
Plants are still able to take up more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as the temperatures get warmer. And this is a pretty consistent trend across the entire Arctic boreal region. But then we are increasingly seeing situations where microbes are then also releasing carbon. For example, during the kind of period outside the summer season. So we have the plants and then we have the microbes. But in addition to that, we have the carbon emissions from fires, and so basically burning. So that's another third.
Well, and that's the, I mean, in a sense, I was wondering if we could separate those out, because the fires we've talked about here on Science in Action, you know, in Siberia and in Canada 2 years ago, absolutely phenomenal. And we're sitting there wondering what they were adding to this system. Because your paper says this is, they are the thing that's sort of changing the sums of it all.
Yes, the fires are an important player. So obviously during the year when the ecosystem burns, it releases large amounts of carbon to the atmosphere. But then also during the years after the fire, ecosystem is not able to take up carbon in a similar way because most of the vegetation is often then burned as well. So it takes a while for the ecosystems to recover. And this is problematic, especially because we know that the frequency and severity and extent of wildfires is currently increasing.
I hadn't thought of that. So it's the way it disrupts. So it's not just that carbon is turned immediately into carbon dioxide during the fires, but the ecosystem recovery is what, several years before things start to grow normally again?
Yes, it is several years. We were not specifically looking at that in our study, but I think site-level studies have shown that it's 10 years plus minus 5. So it takes a time.
I think it's so interesting, it's so important. We've talked loads, I have to say, on the programme about the risk of the Arctic sort of turning around a bit in terms of the climate. And the sense I get from your paper is that in the past two decades, there's definitely some kind of worrying change.
Yes, there is some kind of a worrying change in the carbon cycle dynamics based on our study. But I think it's good to say still that overall, when we look at the Arctic boreal region as a whole, the carbon dioxide sinks are there and they are slightly increasing. But what is worrying is the extent of the carbon dioxide sources. So we have seen that it's more than 30% of the region that is now a carbon dioxide source. That's much more than it previously was. And then when we add the wildfires to the puzzle, then the increasing sink trend gets much, much weaker as well. So yes, there are worrying signs, but then also it's good to keep in mind that the plants are still taking up a lot of carbon. But still, I think the science community thinks that as long as we are able to go back to the kind of original climate situation, then the ecosystems will recover. They will go back to their original state. And that's the main way we can protect this carbon. So we need to stop climate warming as soon as possible so that this Arctic boreal carbon also stays in these soils.
Anna Virkola of the Woodwell Climate Research Centre with A Global Warming. Details published by Nature Climate Change this week. Wildfires like the ones recurring in California at the moment, also drought, ice melt, storms, floods, they're all expressions of the new climate that we're moving into. And as well as breaking the iconic 1.5 degree threshold over a calendar year for the first time, 2024 also saw a record number of deadly landslides, according to a database maintained by geologist Dave Peckley. And climate change was one of the main drivers.
So I've been collecting data on landslides that kill people around the world since 2003, so over 20 years of data now. This year just completed, 2024, is fascinating because the number of fatal landslides that I've recorded is just so much higher than any previous year. So typically over the last decade or so, the number of fatal landslides has been in the range of 350 to 550, but in 2024 the number was 766. So we're talking about, you know, probably 200 fatal landslides more than in any other previous year.
And in terms of how you say fatal, I mean, you can even count how many people have been killed in these.
Yes, that's part of the aim. So we use fatal landslides because those are pretty reliably reported, whereas there are probably hundreds of thousands of landslides happening around the world that don't cause a fatality, but it's very difficult to capture those. And the reports and correspondence and such like that we have allows us to pretty accurately determine the number of people who have been tragically killed in these events. The only exception to that being when there's a really very large fatality event. Sometimes there's considerable uncertainty about how many people might be buried under the mass. And of course, under those circumstances, it can be extremely difficult to recover the victims.
So you're talking about thousands, though, here?
Yes, I mean, the number of people who were killed in landslides in 2024 was about 4,900 people. That number varies actually from year to year quite a lot. And in a really bad year, it might be as high as 15,000. But that would be a year in which there's been a devastating earthquake that's caused very, very large landslides to kill large numbers of people.
Were the events last year dominated by something in a particular region? Was it a particular area that was involved? Or is this actually, you're seeing it all over the place?
Well, about 80% of the landslides that I record are triggered by rainfall. That is the dominant trigger around the world, and that's consistent with time. So when we see this very high incidence of landslides, what we're probably seeing is some impact of the way that rainfall is behaving globally. So that is the sort of underlying cause. The distribution is interesting. In most years, the global hotspot for landslides that kill people is in Asia, and in particular in South Asia, so along the southern edge of the Himalayas, for example, where we have high topography, a vulnerable population, and monsoon rainfall. And that is the case this year as well. But this year we've also seen a much greater geographical spread of fatal landslides. So large numbers occurring, for example, in the eastern part of Africa, in Central and South America, and also in China.
So this sort of stands alongside the idea that 2024 saw some pretty exceptional rainfall events.
Yes, that's right. So slopes are exquisitely sensitive to very, very intense rainfall. So if you imagine a cloudburst type rainfall event, you know, a thunderstorm coming through and depositing very high rainfall intensities, those tend to be the events that trigger landslides that kill people. And they're very often shallow landslides that then turn into debris flows, you know, flows that then move down the valley and typically then hit houses downstream. And so what this data is probably telling us is that the frequency of which we've had very intense rainfall events is much higher than in most normal years. Now, that actually fits with the fact that 2024 had exceptionally high global atmospheric temperatures. So the hypothesis is that high atmospheric temperatures, of course, that's a combination of anthropogenic climate change, global warming, and the El Nino event that we've just been through. Those high temperatures allow much more moisture to be captured in the atmosphere, and then that comes out as rainfall. So probably what we're seeing is very, very high intensity rainfall events occurring more frequently because of the high global temperatures.
Dave Peckley, whose daytime job is Vice Chancellor of Hull University, but he still finds time to maintain a global database of landslides, a database we first heard about back in 2018 here on Science in Action from the BBC. At least we can report today some progress on the tech to reduce the greenhouse gases that we emit. Ammonia is an essential chemical feedstock and the main industrial source of fertiliser we need to feed the world. It may also become an alternative fuel in the future. But the brutal chemistry of making it by reacting hydrogen with nitrogen from the air over hot iron catalysts in the Haber-Bosch process is currently responsible for nearly 500 million tonnes of carbon dioxide pollution each year. That's because the hydrogen is derived from natural gas, with CO2 being an unavoidable byproduct. But a team at MIT in Massachusetts has taken the first steps, showing ammonia can be made starting with water, not in a factory, but on hot rocks deep underground. Team leader Onatim Abate told me the anecdote that got him thinking geothermal.
So in Mali, in West Africa, in the 1980s, the locals were looking for underground water. It turns out the site where they were trying to drill or dig has certain type of rocks that has been reacting with the underground water for God knows how long and converting the water to hydrogen. So the guy who was digging, unfortunately, he was smoking while he was doing that, not knowing that there is hydrogen reserve under his feet. And as you can imagine, there was a boom, an explosion that happened that I think took his life. But later on, people went back to do research on this site. What caused this explosion? And indeed, the rocks has been reacting with the water, making hydrogen for several years. So that was the aha moment for me, that the earth can also be a factory. You know, it has all the substances of, you know, reactant and chemicals and heat and pressure to actually make chemicals. So my idea was, how about we use this free hydrogen from the subsurface to directly make ammonia without involving any methane or any other CO2. That way, you are solving this big issue of energy-intensive process of making ammonia or Haber-Bosch.
So what's the process that you imagine doing? And I guess you've tried it in the lab, at least on a small scale.
Good question. We made a custom-made reactors that simulate the subsurface heat and pressure conditions. Second, we collected rocks from different parts of the US, from California or Oregon. And the idea was to inject water for a source of hydrogen and nitrogen sources to combine them on the rock surface to make ammonia directly from that.
So you're pumping water with nitrogen in it. This is nitrate, I take it.
So it can be nitrate, it can be N2, any kind of nitrogen sources. So we have probably a liter size of reactor. And we found out that actually, when you do this injection, you can indeed make ammonia directly from this reaction.
So how hot are you having to raise the temperatures? Are you putting this at high pressure at all? Yeah. And, you know, is this stuff fizzing or is it sort of slightly bubbling very slowly?
So in terms of the heat and the pressure, we can control reactions by manipulating chemical and physical parameters. For example, we can add catalyst. We can control the pH. We can add some additives that could enhance the speed of the reaction. And a very good case scenario, when you have a good catalyst, good pH, even at one atmosphere and then at ambient temperature, we can still make ammonia. And of course, if you go higher also, you can have more and more yield. So, you know, maybe it's a good segue about what I'm envisioning beyond this one. So actually, I co-founded a company to translate these results from the lab to the real world. So if I scale up the current yield I found in my lab, which is about 2 kilograms of ammonia per ton of rocks, if you scale this up to, you know, a commercial facility, that will yield to 40,000 kilo of ammonia per day.
Which sounds quite a lot. It's not going to solve the need for fertilizer on its own, but I guess the idea is you'd have money. So at the moment, you've got a glass vessel, I imagine, or maybe it's a metal vessel in your lab, and you've filled it with broken rock, you're pumping the stuff through, and you're getting the ammonia out. On a commercial scale, I mean, this would require presumably some kind of pumping station, or maybe two pumping stations. So you're putting water down in one place, it goes through the rocks, and then the other side, you're pumping
Correct.
The water back out.
So it's a two-borehole system, two-well system. So in one hole, we inject the water, the catalyst, and the nitrogen source. In the other well, we collect the ammonia and the water. Correct.
And how deep do you think this would be?
The exact depth really depends on the location, on how the heat profile and the pressure profile change as a function of depth. But in general, it's probably a few hundred meters.
So not that deep then?
Not that deep, yeah.
I suppose what I'm wondering is, it's one thing to do this in a lab where you've got control on the water flow. If you're putting this into the rocks, presumably some of the water will go off to the left and the right. I don't know. How much of the ammonia do you think you'd collect? I suppose these are the things you need to try next and see how it really works.
Correct. But there's already existing knowledge on geothermal heating that we are learning from, but also methane extraction in the past decades, how to inject the fluid and collect, let's say, oil or collect other fluids. So we don't solve all the problems right now, indeed, but then there's some in existing technology we are learning from. And with the company we are working on is to test these ideas in the next year to two to learn more and to optimize it more.
I mean, it's interesting. I've been to one of the big ammonia producing plants in the UK, one of these Haber Bosch plants, and they're massive and they're noisy and they're energetic. And that is what a lot of industrial chemistry is like. I guess in a funny way, what you're saying is that, first of all, you get heat and pressure for free if you go to the Earth. And also the rocks that are down there are in a different chemical state from the materials up here on the surface. And so you're getting a lot of the chemistry, you're getting a lot of the process for free if you just go and dig into the Earth to find the resources there.
That's correct. Maybe it also helps to explain, these rocks are unique rocks. They must contain iron. So they must contain the iron, and they are called ultramafic rocks because they contain high amount of iron and some magnesium as well. The mafic is coming from that. So what happens actually, you know, if you go take one step into the fundamentals here, we're trying to use this reaction where we oxidize the iron.
You're making the iron more rusty, effectively.
We're making a rust, exactly. We're making a rust while we are using that energy, that process, to break the bond and form the ammonia.
And so ultramafic, if I hear geologists say that, I think of places like Iceland and volcanoes and so on. I mean, that's your ideal rock, is it?
Actually, you know, the rock itself, the ultramafic rocks, they are very, very abundant. And as you know, iron is the most abundant metal on Earth. It's almost everywhere. And in fact, people have done back of the envelope calculation how much iron we have near the Earth's surface. And then if we are using it to make hydrogen or ammonia, we will have sufficient hydrogen and ammonia supplying all our energy needs and chemical needs for the next 250,000 years and beyond.
Unetim Abate of MIT, already thinking about how to scale up his lab bench experiments for the real world. They're reported today in the journal Joule. You can find a link to that, to his lab, and more on the other stories in this episode at the Science in Action webpage at bbcworldservice.com. Finally, the electronic sounds of outer space. The ionized space around planet Earth, in this case, a chorus of chirps radiated by spiraling electrons trapped by the Earth's magnetic field. They have been studied for decades, and the experts thought they had a theory to explain it all, but these new satellite recordings are putting those ideas to the test, as I heard from space weather expert Richard Horn of the British Antarctic Survey. Yeah, they have a role in this too.
We've been recording very low-frequency radio waves in the Antarctic at our Halley Research Station since about 1967, and done it continuously since then. So these are signals, chorus waves are signals, they're short bursts of electromagnetic radiation, but when we convert them from electromagnetic waves into sound waves, they're in a frequency range which we can hear, you know, with the normal ear. And they sound like a dawn chorus. It sounds like birds chirping at dawn, which you would normally hear, you know, in spring, something like that.
But they come from far further above our heads.
Well, they come from outer space. Yes, they're generated in space. They're generated around the Earth, where the Earth's magnetic field looks rather like a bar magnet. So that extends out to geostationary orbit, some 36,000 kilometers from the surface of the Earth. And they're generated in space, and they're loosely guided along the Earth's magnetic field, and some of them manage to reach the ground where we can pick them up.
These new ones, though, come from even further afield.
So there's a new paper out, which is, got a really interesting set of results. They've detected these waves something like 160,000 kilometres out in space. So that's way out, much further out on the night side of the Earth. And it's in a region where the Earth's magnetic field is highly distorted.
This week on Witness History, the Unabomber terrorized Americans in a 17-year bombing campaign, killing three people. I've been speaking to Special Agent Kathleen Puckett, who reveals how the FBI tracked him down. Listen on Witness History, the podcast that takes you to the biggest moments in history, told by the people who were there. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1,000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
So it's quite unusual. It really is an unusual and unexpected observation.
So just you say on the night side, so you've got the solar wind, as it were, blowing across the Earth all the time. And this is downstream, but a substantially downstream. And there's a kind of the end of a drip line, as it were, of magnetic field being stretched out. By, is that right? By the solar wind?
That's exactly right. The solar wind coming away from the sun, it compresses the magnetic field on the day side of the Earth, and it stretches the magnetic field out into a long, long tail on the night side of the Earth. And these new observations have been observed in that region where the Earth's magnetic field is very highly stretched. So the magnetic field strength and the magnetic field gradient are completely different. And that has an important implications for the theory on how these waves are generated.
Well, it's interesting you use the word stretched, because I was trying to think of an analogy with a guitar. If you pluck the string, you have a stretched string, and the string is sort of vibrating and makes the sound. In the same way, are these electrons sort of, I don't know, sort of being moving along these stretched magnetic field lines and wobbling around or something?
It's not quite the same. There are oscillations in the Earth's magnetic field. The magnetic field does actually behave like that, but these are higher frequency. So what's actually happening is that you have electrons which are traveling along the Earth's magnetic field, and they travel in a spiral kind of motion, a bit like a corkscrew, if you like. And as they do that, they emit radio waves, special kind of radio waves.
They're sort of transmitters in their own right.
Yes, okay. You could think of them as a transmitter, if you like. The electrons are radiating energy, radio waves, and the radio waves become amplified by other electrons in space. So the Earth's magnetic field looks like a dipole. We know what the field gradient looks like in a magnetic dipole. But in the region where the Earth's magnetic field is really, really stretched, the field gradients are completely different. And this paper published by Liu et al. Seems to be saying that actually the magnetic field gradient doesn't seem to play much of a role. It's a surprise. It's a big surprise, actually. I think it's a really important paper, and it means we've got to go back to that theory and we've got to start looking at it again and really try to understand what's going on.
Richard Horne of the British Antarctic Survey on those wireless whistles from beyond the edge of the atmosphere. Time was when you had to listen to Science in Action on shortwave radio, you'd hear all kinds of whistles from activity in the ionosphere. But now the BBC's gone digital and we've lost that sideshow, probably for the better. I'm Roland Pease, the producer is Alex Mansfield. We'll be back next time with all kinds of bells and whistles.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter venta.com/horen.